Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 239, the Central South African Powder Magazine and the Destruction of the Amahlubi. Also, Robben Island's somber place in history. When we left off last episode, Amahlubi chief Langale Belele and a few hundred warriors had sought shelter inside Basutoland, crossing the Drakensberg Mountains through Bushman's River Pass in November 1873. When the British tried to send columns to corner him, one of the columns had been stopped by Amahlubi at the pass, and five of the British troops had been killed, three young Natal carbineers, a Basutu tracker, and a translator. This event had shocked the settlers of Natal, and in response, Lieutenant Governor Chili Pine began a campaign to destroy the Amahlubi and the Amaingwe in their two locations west of the town of where Mooi River is today. The number of incidents of rape and the casual shooting of over 200 Amahlubi, mainly women and children, took place in the hands of African levies hired to help smoke out these people. The Amaingwe were in no way directly connected to the Langali Balele affair. They lived further west, up on the slopes of the Drakensberg, at the headwaters of the Little Tugela in the Injisutu Valley. But they too were targeted in the aftermath of the Bushman's River Pass incident. Pine declared martial law. Most of the Amaingwe and Amahlubi men fled, and the British rounded up the women and children and the elderly. The women and children were placed in the charge of friendly chiefs in the upcountry districts, while the old men were sent to Pietermaritzburg to be kept under surveillance by other friendly black chiefs there. A small group of Amaingwe living near Ladysmith, that were totally unconnected to any of these goings-ons, were raided by the magistrates Isinduna and their property plundered. On the 30th of November, Pine ordered all huts in both locations, the Amahlubi and the Amaingwe, to be burned down and all property destroyed. On the 17th of December, as a kind of afterthought, Pine followed this up with a declaration that all Amaingwe were now officially dispossessed of their land. The arbitrary killings of both clans continued mostly by the African levies under the watchful eyes of colonial officers who appeared to be egging them on. Major Anthony Durnford, a professional soldier and engineer who'd been wounded by the Amahlubi during the Battle of Bushman's River Pass, was one of the few who spoke up against the bloodletting. "There have been sad sights," he reported. "Women and children butchered by our black allies, too often unhappily by the permission and encouragement of the white leaders. Old men, too. The burnt villages, dead women. It was horrible." Then the Natal Legislative Council passed a highly contentious law drawn up by Pine, which indemnified all colonial forces for any act committed during this period. Two columns of volunteers and African levies were searching for Langali Balele. One headed to East Griqualand, while the other rode back to Bushman's River Pass, following the spoor left by the Amahlubi cattle. The warriors had taken all the cattle into Basutoland to join their chief. Natal authorities were offering a £1 reward per warrior captured and 100 cattle for Langali Balele, dead or alive. The Amahlubi chief was deep inside Basutoland, close to the Senqu River, the Orange, about 50 kilometres west of the Bushman's River Pass. By early January, several hundred men and about 7,000 cattle assembled under his command. He had no plan about what to do. His original idea was to escape from the British, then ponder next steps. But now he was in Sotho territory, very much out of his depth. According to oral tradition, he held out hope of some kind of negotiated deal with the Natal authorities. That was dashed when he received word about the three volunteer carbineers who had been killed and the reward offered for his head. He realized there would be no negotiating. The rainy season hammered the mountains, and the Amahlubi warriors were exposed to the lashing rains. It may have been summer, but as we know, who've been in those mountains, the temperature drops to freezing sometimes on the highest peaks. While he and his men hunkered down, a tremor was rippling through southern Africa. Reports of what was going on in Natal spread, and the death of the three carbineers convinced most settlers that a general rebellion could be underway, the feared black uprising. Boers in the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republiek and the Free State formed commandos and sent them to the borders in case Langali Balele showed up, or in case any of the chiefs that surrounded their territories decided to join in. Eastern Cape and Natal English farmers sent their women and children into towns, battening down their farm hatches. Their fears were heightened by the role that Basutoland was appearing to play. In the minds of the colonists, this mountain kingdom was thought of as the central South African powder magazine, a place no one could control that could go off, full of guns bought by workers on the diamond fields and the farms. It was in the heartland, the center of South Africa, annexed by the British in 1868, ruled by a new king, Letsie, who had succeeded Moshoeshoe. Although annexed finally to the Cape in 1871, it remained a highly unstable land in the minds of the colonists. Langali Baleli had no idea about all of this as he considered his next steps inside Basutoland. The British had also mobilized hundreds of troops who boarded the HMS Rattlesnake in Cape Town and were en route to Bolster Natal, while a large police force rode into Basutoland from the Cape's eastern frontier region. In East Griqualand, Adam Cork's Griqua also mobilized in support of the British. Basuta King Letsie and his councillors were warned by the British not to help the Amatlubi and to send patrols into the mountains to find the missing chief. It took Basuta chief Morapo 5 weeks to locate the Amatlubi in the upper Senkhu Valley. Some of his warriors came across Langali Baleli and adopted a friendly attitude, even warning him about the British posse, which was probably going to find him soon. The Amatlubi chief felt more confident then and decided to accompany Morapo's men back to their chief's territory. He was considering possibly asking for asylum from the Basutu king. Better to surrender to Letsie than let himself fall into the hands of the vengeful colonists heading his way. When Chief Morapo heard that the Amatlubi were coming, he immediately sent word to the magistrate at Leribe, Major Charles Bell. The British officer mobilized his small police force, who joined Morapo's warriors, and finally sent word to Langali Baleli to surrender. The Amatlubi chief was exhausted, but even now he refused to surrender directly to the British. Instead, he handed himself over to Chief Morapo on the 11th of December 1873. 90 of his men rode into the chief's homestead along with him. Most of the Amatlubi warriors in Basutoland had remained behind in the Senkhu Valley protecting their cattle. They knew the Basutu were eyeing this rich prize. They were not interested in surrendering. Morapo's men led Bell's police force to where they hid, and in the ensuing firefight, 10 Tlubi were killed. The rest fled. A few were captured within a day or two, hiding in the mountains. Most made their getaway. The cattle were in the hands of the government forces. On the 13th of December, the two Natal columns arrived at Morapo's homestead at Leribe, and Captain Albert Allison took charge of Langali Baleli. Also arrested were 5 of his sons and 12 Isinduna. Letsie and Morapo were quite happy to see the back of Langali Baleli, but when it came to the cattle, that was another matter entirely. They demanded payment for helping the British, who gave Morapo 2,000 cattle. The rest were going to Natal with Captain Allison. The two Natal columns began their trip back via Oliver's Hook Pass and arrived in Pietermaritzburg on the last day of 1873. Langali Baleli and his sons and Isinduna were thrown into jail. The Amatlubi leader then discovered what Pine's plans were for his land. He was shaken to the core. The British were going to dismantle his chiefdom. Lieutenant Governor Pine had already issued orders that 2 locations in the middle of the Amatlubi and Amangwe land be surveyed into farms of between 2,000 and 3,000 acres each. All applications by colonists for this land were to be made to him personally. We intend to clear the 2 locations and to repeople them entirely by white settlers, he told the Colonial Office in London. Priority would be given to the Natal Carbineers and the other volunteers who joined the expedition in pursuit of Langali Baleli. Within a year, 160 applications had been lodged, mostly by upcountry farmers, but also by locals, like the magistrate of Vienen, John MacFarlane, who applied on behalf of his son. It was John MacFarlane who had helped instigate the entire Langali Baleli affair by his handling of the firearms registration process all those months before. And here he was, benefiting personally. Authorities were on a roll. They announced that all Amatlubi women and children would be forced to work on farms as apprentices. This was the thinly veiled version of slavery that the Trek Boers preferred, where workers would receive no payment other than food and shelter for a period of time, a so-called apprenticeship system. These people had no other choice. Their men were in jail or on the run. And so several hundred Amahlubi and Amaingwe women and children were sent to work. In January, Natal's Legislative Council formalised the system by passing Law 18 of 1874, empowering the Lieutenant Governor to assign convicts to work for private individuals and even companies for the duration of their sentences. The farmers in the territory had complained bitterly for years that black workers preferred toiling on their own land or earning money on Cape farms or on the diamond fields to actually working for them. Now they had a flow of easy labour. That's not overstated. The Natal Witness newspaper, for example, was quite cheerful in its editorial at the end of January 1874. The labour problem will progress remarkably after a great importation of slaves, Langala Belelians and Putians. The Putini were the settlers' name for the Amaingwe. Within a few months, 530 Hlubi men and women had been processed into forced labour camps in Pietermaritzburg and Vianen districts. Lieutenant Governor Pine applied to Cape Governor Sir Henry Barclay for permission to move Langali Balele from Pietermaritzburg to Robben Island after his impending trial. His fate was already sealed, but just for the record, Natal authorities wanted to secure his conviction and sentence in a court of law. That's to keep the colonial office happy. On the 16th of January, 1874, Langali Balele's trial began, and it was, to put it mildly, a mockery of justice. Natal's authorities had decreed that blacks were supposed to be processed according to their customary laws, and here was Langali Balele sitting in a colonial court. Natal's Ordinance No. 3 of 1849 had invested the Lieutenant Governor with all the executive and judicial authority of Supreme Chief over the native tribes, as they put it. This meant that customary law would be administered via the Lieutenant Governor, not colonial law. But Langali Balele's trial was not conducted in terms of customary law, so the Lieutenant Governor could not act as the judge, which is what he did. The court included the judge, who was Lieutenant Governor Chili Pine, and a total of 17 assessors, all part of the colonial administration, rather than lawyers per se. One of the assessors was David Erskine, whose son Robert had been killed during the Battle of Bushman's River Pass, and he was thirsting for revenge. The prosecutor was John Shepston, who was implicated in the entire saga because of his actions during the Manchana affair. Some noted that elsewhere, a chief who behaved like this would have been dispatched without hesitation. Here, the settlers remarked with a certain smugness, he would instead be handed the courtesy of a guilty verdict under their somewhat imperfect justice system. Instead of the customary law process being followed, the trial began with Langali Balele being asked to plead. His pleas had been entered as guilty. The court then began to hear selected witnesses for the prosecution to determine just how guilty he was. The Amahlubi chief, in turn, was not allowed to call defence witnesses, nor was he allowed a lawyer. That was until Bishop Colenso intervened, demanding a chief be given some sort of counsel. But Pine placed a host of conditions on the lawyer, including being denied access to his client. Eventually, the lawyer withdrew before proceedings got underway, and Langali Balele went to trial, representing himself. The chief witness for the prosecution was Mahuyiza, the messenger, who had said that he'd been stripped and searched by Langali Balele's men back in October 1873. Soon it became apparent that most of what he told the court was a succession of lies, but the court ruled that the lies didn't matter because Langali Balele had pleaded guilty. On the 9th of February, the chief was found guilty and banished from Natal for life. But where? At this stage, banishment meant not in Natal, and it was illegal for the black chiefs to be banished to the Cape. More about this in a moment. While Langali Balele's trial was underway, 9 members of the court met under the presidency of Theophilus Shepston to decide what to do about the chief's sons and Isinduna. With John Shepston as prosecutor once more, they were accused of illegally removing themselves and their cattle from Natal. On the 27th of February, 8 were found guilty, 7 sentenced to hard labour between 6 months and 2.5 years, and Langali Balele's son, Malambuli, was banished for 5 years. 220 other Amatlubi men were also put on trial, most found guilty and sentenced. One, who had killed an African levy, went to jail for 20 years, while all the others received between 2 to 7 years. It was these men who ended up on local farms. The colonists had got their labour for free. By March 1874, the Amatlubi, as a people, were shattered and scattered. They'd lost their land, their cattle, their leaders in jail. The Natal government's aim of destroying what they saw as a dangerous obstacle to the establishment of closer control over their African citizens had been successfully achieved. The words of historian John Wright in his book The Tlubi Chiefdom of Zululand Natal. For many years, the settlers had been pressurizing the British authorities to open up more land, and here it was, vast tracts of green rolling hills, perfect for cattle. But a small minority of colonists were vociferous in their condemnation for what they saw as a trumped-up case. Bishop Colenso, in particular, was incensed about the whole matter and was determined that what had taken place didn't fade into historical obscurity. He blamed Shipston for the entire affair, and their relationship was irrevocably ruptured. The bishop began the business of arranging an appeal on behalf of the chief to the Natal Executive Council. At first, Pine refused, but then let it go ahead because he, after all, was going to be in charge of that appeal process. In the meantime, he hurried off to Cape Town to meet Governor Barclay to urge the Cape government to pass legislation permitting Langali Balele to be banished onto Robben Island. It was a moment heavy with history. Until then, only blacks from Cape Territories had been cast out to that place of silence, but now the sombre idea had taken root that black men and women from across southern Africa too might be sent to the island. Pine ordered a general amnesty for all other Amahlubi and Amaingwe rebels at large. Anyone returning would be forgiven, and then, of course, they would be sent to work on settlers' farms. He was forced to do this because roving bands of Amahlubi and Amaingwe men were hiding out in the mountains and periodically robbing livestock from the locals. Eventually, Colonial Secretary Lord Carnarvon back in England found out about all of this and was starting to ask questions about what was going on. The humanitarians of Great Britain had also heard about the women and children sent to farms as virtual slaves and about the farce parading as trial. In May 1874, Carnarvon was shocked to find out about Pine's law exonerating Natal forces for any act they committed during their mopping up operations. And in June, he ordered Pine to stop sending prisoners to white farms as apprentices slash slaves. Pine was desperate to get Langali Balele out of Natal for a number of reasons, and one in particular was quite ironic. While the chief was in jail there, a violent hailstorm had hammered Pietermaritzburg. Local people said that the Amahlubi chief was known for his abilities to conjure up rain, and it was he who'd called down the anger of the heavens on the settlers. The second reason why Pine was trying to get Langali Balele to the Cape was that AmaZulu King Cetshwayo Kampande had sent messengers demanding that the Amahlubi chief be sent to live with him. Meanwhile, Colenso's appeal to the Natal Executive Council failed, so he approached Natal's Supreme Court on the grounds it was illegal in terms of British law to banish people from one colony to another. That was also rejected by the court. Langali Balele and his son were secretly hustled onto a ship in Durban Harbour, and it sailed for the Cape on August 5th. A month earlier, the Cape Parliament had obligingly passed a law empowering the governor to imprison Langali Balele on Robben Island. It had happened. But things were unravelling somewhat for Pine and Shipston. Under pressure from Carnarvon, the lieutenant governor wrote that he would be allowing the Amahlubi and Amaingwe back onto their land. That was only going to be half-heartedly applied, however. Under more pressure from the colonial office, Pine commuted all sentences, and the 220 or so men on the farms now had to be paid. The women and children and the elders who'd been sent to live with other African chiefs rejoined their men. In London, Carnarvon had a brainwave. He realized the Langalibalele affair could work to his own advantage in pursuit of plans he'd been developing for the formation of a single confederal white-ruled state in southern Africa. The Natal government's mishandling of the affair gave him an opportunity to intervene in order to fix what was wrong. He could strengthen the authority of the imperial government and diminish the power of Natal's settlers by folding the colony into a larger South African entity. The Boers were not going to like that idea one little bit. Neither were many of the settlers. The African chiefs, even less. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. It helps elevate its visibility. And you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about various episodes. You can email me from there and sign up for a little newsletter. Until we meet again, goodbye.